a very good morning from Bhutan, and here we are into another very interesting episode of our podcast series, Everyday Decoloniality, a Multicultural Initiative. And today we have with us Professor Lewis Gordon, who is an Afro-Jewish philosopher, political thinker, educator, and musician who plays drums and various other percussive instruments and piano as well, and who holds a PhD in philosophy from the Yale University. He is currently working as a professor in the University of Connecticut and is very much actively associated with the Forum on Contemporary Theory, Baroda, Gujarat. So a very warm welcome, Professor, to this podcast episode.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So
in this case, I guess, to communicate here, since we're over the
radio
from distant lands.
And Professor, today we are just going to talk about a very interesting topic, which I guess is close to my heart and as yours as well. That is jazz, hip-hop, blues, and anti-black racism. And this topic actually came in my mind when I was reading through various works of your works and from various dimensions, your interviews, your articles, your book chapters. And I am thinking of discussing about how these aspects basically turn towards decolonial aesthetics as you portray and project and argue through your work. So as an individual, what I really found is that with respect to your writings, lectures, interviews, music in its various forms, plays actually a very pivotal role. For instance, you write on Jimi Hendrix, you argue about the whitening of the blues, jazz and hip-hop music, you play drum beats to start your lecture, you play drum beats to convey messages during your lectures, and you verbally invoke multiple examples from your musical experiences and associations during your talks. So altogether, various patterns of music have widely contributed towards shaping your theoretical and philosophical arguments till date. So, can you share with us some of the factors that influenced you to invoke music within your habitual thinking and doing?
Ah, well, thank you for the question. It covers a wide field. Now, the short part, if we go a little backward, you brought up the question of decoloniality. And decoloniality or decolonization made no sense without freedom. And when we think about freedom is expressed in many ways. But when we're talking about an aesthetic expression of freedom, jazz is the sine qua non of this. Because jazz is not only about the music that is played, but the idea that each person comes to it and transforms it. So that means the artist is simultaneously a performer and a composer. And that gives a sense in how we live our lives, because at the same time, we are participating in the world with others, but we're also performing our lives. We're building it together. And if it works beautifully together, it's an expression of freedom. One example, of course, is when you think about how jazz musicians get together. Although you could have rehearsals, I could just go anywhere, and it's jazz musicians who develop the jam session. I mean, I could meet jazz musicians anywhere in the world, and they could just count off, and we could play music. And the reason we can do this is because we listen to each other, and we also understand the freedom of the form. Now, jazz, of course, blues, and a lot of those others influence many other forms of music, including, that's why people could have funk jam sessions, they could have rock jam sessions, but also when I'm in India, for instance, there are ways in which we could just get together with tablas or whatever and have a jam session. And so the point is not that jazz is the unique expression of this, it's just jazz is one of the forms that's committed to this. And in terms of me with music, I started playing music when I was a child. And a lot of things that people don't realize about music is it's a central part of our entering the social world. Through music, through rhythm, through timing, we learn to communicate with each other, we perform with each other, and in fact, a really good conversation is a lot like a musical performance. Now, in terms, so for me, music was not only a part of my life in terms of performing music, but I can't get through a day without playing music. And in fact, even when I write articles, every book, every story has a leitmotif, in other words, a soundtrack, a musical element to keep it going. And this is because we live in many dimensions. We live in the visual dimension of how we are able to articulate each other. We live in a temporal dimension, but we also live in a communicative dimension. And that communicative dimension requires a form of cohesion, a form of rhythmic connectedness that enables us to not only communicate with each other, but to build meanings. So, on a very basic level, music is one of the dimensions through which we're able to express life. And for me, when I present a paper, I refuse to be a talking head just sitting there talking at an audience. I would rather bring as many of the senses and modes of communication together, because I also treat live lectures like a jazz performance in the sense that although we may know what we're going to talk about, the real talking is in the how and what occurs, which means the audience contributes to it.
That's actually very interesting, because, and you were mentioning about how you, introduce music, or how you see music through your writings as well. For instance, you said when you're writing a paper or when you're writing a book, how you see the layers of rhythms in there. And quite interestingly, currently in India also, what we see is especially among the Dalit community. And this was actually coming in my mind when I was currently working on your reader, and I was just looking through your articles on jazz and hip hop and various other things. And the Dalit community, especially in Kerala, in the state of Kerala, what they're doing is they're trying to voice their subjugation, trying to bring forth their voices, not through anymore through just road protests and banners and or silent marches. What they're doing is they're doing it through raps, they're doing it through hip hops, they're doing it through poetry, they're doing it through performance. So music is altogether has always been across the world, irrespective of geopolitical and spatio-temporal moments, have always been a very powerful tool of communication, powerful tool of protest, powerful tool of resistance. And so with respect to this, now I wish to come to a more specific aspect. And this aspect is associated with the phenomena of racism. So what I see with respect to my experiences in India is that what I have observed till date is when we engage with the concepts of race and racism, consciously or unconsciously, what happens is we automatically get transported within the compartments of black-white binary. But as we take into account the various forms of racial discriminations that are taking place across the globe today, we find that racism has ventured out of this black-white binary long time back. And in fact, the same is applicable in case of India as well. For instance, we talk about Hindu mania, we talk about Islamophobia, we talk about the oppression of Dalits, subjugation of outcasts, etc. And the dimensions of racial subjugations in this manner are getting wider day by day. So within this space of the wider dimensions of racial subjugations, your powerful arguments with respect to anti-black racism, I guess, demands a special attention, because I believe that this aspect of racism has been quite underrated till date. And this belief has been constructed, obviously, with my respective experiences in India. And for a long time, at least in India, anti-black racism only existed within brackets, within footnotes and endnotes, or as something we connote as further references. So therefore, I believe that your engagements consistently make us realize that it is time to bring this underrated aspect into the surface and engage with it, not just as a common generalized backdrop of racial problems, but also as a very specific forefront of racial problems. So as a scholar working on anti-Black racism for so many decades, why do you think that this phenomena is so underestimated? And you have been in India, you have engaged with so many Indian scholars across the country as well. So what do you think? Where lies the problems?
Well, the first thing to think about with racism is that most in racist societies, people learn from the moment they're born the art of how to evade talking about it. So it's just like even if we're going to talk about everything from the treatment of Dalit, Shudras, different groups in India, it's there right in front of us, but people learn to talk around it or not confront it directly. And part of it is because societies would like to project on themselves a better image of themselves. To talk about this issue requires talking about the dirty laundry of a society. So that's one thing. But the more complicated thing is the actual story around these issues. Because on the one hand, there's the historical story, and on the other hand, there's the psychoanalytical story, there's the semiological story, there's the specific story of the history of colonialism, the story of capitalism. One big thing that what's tricky about talking about racism is that a lot of people want to have a one shoe size that fits all answer. But the human world doesn't work that way. So the first thing we have to think about if we're talking about any kind of hatred is to bear in mind we're talking about how it functions in the human world. And within that world, there are certain patterns we might see. So the first thing to bear in mind is, if we're talking about specifically racism, it requires identifying a group of human beings and then find ways to deny that those group of human beings are human beings. Mm-hmm. So all racisms require learning how to be a liar. That's the first part. Okay, we have to lie to ourselves that the very thing that was needed, which is to be able to spot there them being human being, was not there when we unleash racial hatred on people. The second thing that we have to bear in mind is that we often want to have people's identities or whoever's the object of racism fixed. So we treat, if we're talking about any group, from the racial hatred of Jews to indigenous peoples, if we're talking about the Ainu of Japan, for instance, if we're talking about the complex issues between Dravidians and, you know, things in the north in India, all the long list goes through. If we're talking about anti-Black racism, the thing we don't realize is, first of all, that there are a lot of people in the world who are not historically Black. It's that there are certain groups of people who are identified in a certain way that led to processes to transform them into Black. Now, the one thing when we realize this is that there were different groups that were Black at different times in history. A lot of people today don't realize, for instance, that the British for a while, because they projected on a large area the concept of India, when they encountered them and saw these darker people, they were first called Blacks. If we look at the indigenous peoples of Australia, they're called Blacks, whether they are Koori, et cetera. People call them Aboriginals, but, you know, they're Black. Maori are called Black, and there's so many different ethnic groups on the African continent that were piled together from light to dark called Black. So this already tells us that Black is pretty sloppy. But the other part, though, is that the imposition of an identity on a people is not all that the people are. And people always are transforming what's imposed on them into something new. So on the one hand, there's the racism created Black, you know, the racist notion of Black, which is anti-Black. But the people who became listed as Black found creative ways to assert their humanity. And they began to create a different kind of Black, a positive Black, capital B Black, whether it's in terms of Black liberation struggles, Black aesthetics. We started off, for instance, about music, and it was peculiar. We're talking about Black music. And this tells you something rather profound. For instance, let me just go back for a second to talking about, say, jazz. One of the cool things when I was an adolescent in the 70s was that in Harlem, right, which is a black center of New York, there were a group of jazz musicians, and these were some of the most famous jazz musicians, you know, for a good portion of the 20th century. You know what I mean? They're talking about people like Dizzy Gillespie, Billy Taylor, Frank Foster, huge people. They decided, these group of jazz musicians, to get the city to let them use a middle school for a weekend. And in that middle school, what they did was they charged $10 a year, which was just to pay for the utilities, to have the building used by jazz musicians to teach inner city young people jazz. And I used to go there, and it was remarkable. And they purposely, and this, you know, you look at jazz musicians, these are guys who walk around in ties, suits, you know, they were very dapper. But they chose one of the roughest areas of Harlem. I mean, like, at that time, you could see the heroin needles in the streets, there was a high crime prostitution area where you'd see condoms all over, you know. But they were brilliant in this. They wanted young people to walk through that neighborhood to get into that building, because these men in their dapper suits and the women who were involved were, you know, they too walked through it because they were reminding people that jazz came out of the experiences of the damned of the earth, right? And so to go to some like rich conservatory to go sit down with a group of jazz musicians, yeah, you could learn technique, but you don't learn the political existential commitment of the music unless you walk through that community. And you could imagine there are parts of India a similar position. It's different if you set up a place for learning where you have to go through the poorest of the communities to meet the best musicians in the country. And what was striking is it was on Saturday and Sunday mornings at 8 a.m. And I remember it because I went there, I'd go and I'd play with these people. And then one day it struck me, wait a minute. If these musicians are showing up at 8 a.m. on a Saturday morning, you know where they were up until about 4 a.m. that morning. Because jazz is played in clubs, bars, and you know what I mean? In places where that means these men only had time to go get some breakfast and then came to teach us. And then they would teach us the whole day, and then they'll go home, take a nap, and Saturday night, that's when you make your money as a jazz musician. Hmm. And then so Sunday morning, they'll be right back there. So when we think about the profound level of political commitment, Why were they doing this? They weren't being paid. They were right, and these were some of the. This is a dimension of these musicians that people don't understand, and that means they understood not only the aesthetic dimension of the music, they understood its political significance, because I've always seen jazz as an allegory for real democracy. The idea that when you perform as a jazz musician, your job is not only to do your best performance, but when another person is taking the lead, your job is to do your best to get her or him to do his or her best performance. So you're going to drive the trumpeter if you're a piano player. I'm going to have to not overplay the drums. I have to hit it just enough so that person could shine. And think about that as an allegory of society. The idea that we try to get the people in our society to flourish, to prosper, to shine. And so if we come back to some of these issues, racism, of course, is about blocking all those capacities. And so if we think about this multidimensional way of looking, we go back to its roots. Racism proper as a concept came out of the conflicts between Christendom and Islam. It was in that context that, particularly in Iberia, in Andalusia, in those places, in the Middle, what's called the Middle Ages. It's just that's a European, I don't like the term Middle Ages because it marks history and reality according to European perception of time and things. Because the caliphates, they were just the modern age, you know. And so Raza or Reza referred to Jews and Moors. And Moors are Afro-Muslims. And Jews, those Jews were more brown. They were, Afro-Jews. But anyway, that initial designation of race also points in its significance to the notion of those who belong elsewhere. And so racism is always starting with the idea of people who are not belonging. And if we radicalize this notion of not belonging, it can get to the point of reaching the claim that you don't belong to the species, you don't belong to the human world. So some people say racism is about othering or making people to others, but I actually argue that racism is worse than that. Racism is about trying to push people into the not other and the not self. And that's more profound. And this is how it connects to the idea of why black becomes a rather interesting category. Because, you see, black functions outside of, if we're talking about historically, ethnically designated black people, I'm talking about the semiological, the sign, significance of black. The logic that blackness represents the absence of light begins to, because to project onto a people, because technically speaking, we don't meet people who are the color black. It's a political designation. But the idea is to say it's the opposite of white, which of course leads to the logic of creating a notion of whiteness that is a kind of purity. The problem, of course, is if there were only whiteness, it would have no principle of differentiation, so it'll disappear. So ironically, blackness and whiteness are parasitic of each other. They're symbiotically linked in a way that makes the absurdity of trying to eliminate the other, you know, a performative contradiction. However, what it does reveal is that the tag of blackness can be placed on any group. There's the, you know, which brings out its fluidity. So blackness has a unique role in the history of racism in that it functions not simply as an historical designation, but a symbolic one. In other words, that's why people say you can blacken people. Mm-hmm. And that understanding means that we need to bring together the resources in which there's not a singular field like anthropology, sociology, or history, or philosophy that answers the question of how to understand racism, because the human being is broader than those categories. What is required instead, and this is how I teach it, is an understanding on how the desire to claim that there are certain group of human beings who are uniquely human over others requires the production of sciences, whether good or bad, to rationalize those differences. And so I teach a course called Race and the Birth of the Human Sciences, in which we look at the history of an effort to account for the idea that there's something special about the conqueror or the colonizer or the dominator, leads to the need to produce sciences that rationalize them, and among them are what we call the human sciences. Now, that's a little more abstract. We already know the concrete level is that it's very difficult to go brutalize people, dehumanize them, disenfranchise them, do all kinds of atrocities, and on a daily basis degrade them without having to develop psychological defense mechanisms. And a lot of these usually take the form of rationalizing power relations. And it also is impossible to do that without trying to build institutions to support those differences. But ultimately, what racism leads to is another absurd logic. The absurd logic is the idea of a world of contraries. The world of contraries is a world of absolute separation. So absolute separation would have, say, the white world and the rest. Now, the thing about contraries, of course, is that it gives the illusion that the worlds don't meet. But of course, it all collapses the moment whoever is supposed to be the dominating race looks at someone who's in the dominated race, and a person can say the words, "What are you looking at?" In other words, the moment communication of any kind happens you realize there's a dialectical relationship. And dialectics is the collapse of the logic of contraries. So to put simply, every day a human being opens his or her mouth, every day a human being is able to communicate with another human being, is a revelation of the lie of racism.
I mean, that's really very interesting. And thank you so much for the detailed outline and analysis that you did. So I was just wondering that the way you associate jazz, then racism, and also as an allegory of the social structure, as a political allegory. With these associations, when you enter your classroom, you briefly mentioned about your classroom experiences as well. But when you enter the classroom, you must be having a lot of students from different cultural, from different racial, or maybe from different geographical backgrounds as well. So when you share these aspects with them, so what kind of challenges you face? I'm pretty sure there will be students who can, at a very one shot, can associate with your experience. And also there are students who might feel alienated or maybe disconnected with what you are basically sharing. So at that point, it becomes quite a challenge, because you have such a diverse associations, diverse experiential people coming into one single classroom. So how do you deal with this particular aspect?
Well, the first thing I should mention is I'm in my fourth decade of teaching. So even though I'm a young man, it's rather funny when I show up in certain places, because there are people who've been reading me for years and they didn't realize. These are some of the advantages of being a bit on the precocious or Wundekind side. I remember when I gave a lecture one time in Canada, the person who was reading me for a while, Atusa Chiatu, who's a very famous African philosopher, he thought I was older than him. And, this is a gentleman who's nearly 25 or 30 years my senior. So what it is I've been teaching since I was an adolescent. Okay? Now, within that framework, why I bring this up is I estimate I've taught maybe more than 10,000 people. And I know I've mentored nearly 100 doctoral students. And one of the things I think that was great about my initial teaching experiences, my fears of being a teacher, is that it started with teaching music, piano, drums, etc. And the thing I've learned, which is connected to your question in a very profound way, I should add to that I feel very lucky that I've been able to teach such a broad array of people. There's no ethnic group or racial group or sexual orientation that's not come before me and received mentorship, okay? And so the thing I've learned is that a teacher should make a distinction between being an authority and being authoritative. Some teachers, if they're insecure, they go in and they worry about being an authority leads to them becoming authoritarian. However, it's profound to students if you meet them in a relationship of possibility. So I actually always meet my students with the view that they have a right to be critical, and through our interaction, if what I have to offer is evident, then my legitimacy will be there for them, and I would consequently be authoritative rather than authoritarian. And so I usually have conversations when I meet students. In some cases, there'll be conversations that are very surprising to them. And in some cases, there are conversations for them that in other contexts they would find risky. So, for instance, I remember one time I was in a place where there were mostly poor white kids. And I said, okay, let's have a conversation about black people and white people. And at first they were very nervous, but I asked them to list all the stereotypes they knew of black people on the board. They did. And it took them a while at first, but then they did. And then I asked them, I said, okay, do you believe white people are the opposite of black people? And, you know? So, but then I asked them, I went through each item they put and asked them if they were different. And it turned out every item on the board they put about black people was a reference to themselves. And at that moment, I just said to them, well, you know, y'all are the whitest, the blackest white people then, you know. But the point is basically this. People have to have us understand that learning is a special opportunity to grow. And so it requires a conversation on why you're there and what you're doing. I never teach a course without a conversation on, one, what is a student and what is a teacher or a professor? And two, why should we bother to take the course at all? We shouldn't be afraid to have that conversation. Because once you get that conversation out of the way, if they know why they're taking it, then they have a sense of possibility. They take ownership of it. I usually, for the first one, students usually understand what students are. They're there to learn. But they often think of professors or teachers like gods, you know, or prophets, like Moses coming down with the tablet, or, you know, as if I walk in the room as Lord Shiva or something, you know. And after they go through it, I usually explain to them that I see a professor as a person who fell in love with learning and who continued to learn. And research, the books we write, those are basically updates of our learning and also what we can share. But it also means that because students don't have the exact same experiences as the professors or even each other. So each student is bringing, even though they're at the beginning of the learning and the professor is the advanced student, the beginning student still is adding something to the learning, which is her or his experience that on which we can build. And so that means that for the student there's possibility, for the professor there's possibility, and their experiences of co-learning. I also have conversations with students on what schools are and universities. It's striking to me that I've even met Emerita, or, you know, or Emeritus Professor Emeriti, who have gone through schools their entire life, taught in them, and never had a conversation on what they are, which is bizarre. So what I've found is that being able to cultivate a sense not only of possibility, but a critical relationship to institutions, the understanding that they can have a metacritique. It's fine for them to be involved in the practices of scolae, which is what school is from, which just means leisure time. And it also means that there's an understanding of its link to ideas such as freedom. But also, to witness a person who, for them, knows so much, exemplifying humility through saying there's so much for her or him to learn, brings things into perspective, and it enables a richer opportunity for communication with students. And you could probably tell from each of my responses that I see real communication as a decolonial practice. The more dominating, hegemonic, colonized way of looking at the teacher relationship is for the student to be passive and for the teacher to be dominating. But as we know from Paulo Ferreira, but not only Ferreira, there are other elements of this, Gramsci's notion of critical thinking. It is right there in the writings of Sri Aurobindo when he talks about integral yoga. It's right there. We could see not only Tagore, but we could see it all over the place. We could see it in Kwame Nkrumah. We could see it there in Steve Biko. There's so many exemplars of this, the Japanese thinker Nishitani. And that, what they all understand is that the education is a communicative practice in the art and living of freedom. And even though there may be structures that try to impede those capacities, every act of exemplifying those capacities defies that kind of domination. And of course, every educational moment is the cultivation of possibility. So in that, there are many names for this view, whether it is, you know, critical pedagogy, whether we're going to look at his potentiated double consciousness, as Jane Anna Gordon and I have argued in our writings. We have a theory we call the pedagogical imperative. And what the pedagogical imperative is the realization that the best person with whom to study or from whom to learn is a person who is continuing to learn how to learn, which means then that it's always a community, a group, a social practice.
That's amazing, Professor. I wish we could continue further with the communication, but we will stop here and we will continue it much, I mean, later on for sure. And so thank you so much for your amazing reflections on jazz, on pedagogical imperative, on classroom practices, on being a professor, on racism, anti-Black racism, and various other dimensions that you share. Hope to continue with this conversation and many more things in the near future. Thank you so much once again.